Hey everyone, welcome to the Squanch Wisecracks Rick and Morty podcast. My name is Jared and I'm joined here by the Squanchers. We got Ryan.
Wubba Lubba Go Eagles.
And Alec.
Hey.
So, today we're breaking down Season 1, Episode 3 of Rick and Morty, entitled Anatomy Park. So let's go ahead and, as always, get some first impressions. Let's start with Alec this time. What are your thoughts on revisiting this episode, Mr. Alec?
Maybe B, B minus? It's also funny, I did not remember this was a Christmas episode.
Interesting. So, B minus, is that lower on the scale of Rick and Morty episodes, or how do you feel overall about it in context of other episodes?
Yeah, it's not a bad episode. I don't even know what I'd consider a bad episode, but it's not one of my favorites. You know, I think this is one of the reasons I forgot it was a Christmas episode, is because besides the conceit, not a lot stands out to me. You know, there's obviously some really, really funny jokes. The whole once Reuben is in space, that whole joke is fucking hilarious.
Yeah. All right. What about you, Ryan?
C plus maybe. I'm kind of the same way. Not much sticks out about it. The whole plot of Anatomy Park, all the litany of body jokes or puns, I would say, is just kind of not. I don't know. It doesn't do much for me. I don't like that much.
Yeah, it's like when we talked last time about a good episode to watch on pause with all the Scary Terry stuff. But this one, when you pause it, and yeah, there are some jokes in the background of what the concession stand, what the restaurants are called, and what all the rides are called. But it's all the same thing. It's all like biology puns.
Yeah, exactly.
Except there's just a Quiznos and a Sbarro.
Yeah. Just a Quiznos.
Or a Panda Express.
Right, a Panda Express.
I did like the whole subplot of the grandparents and their lover, or them with the grandma's lover. That whole thing was great with Jerry. But yeah, other than that, you know, it's not a bad episode, but I certainly wouldn't trot it out to show a friend who had never seen Rick and Morty.
Sure. Well, what about in terms of other episodes? Like, would you say it's on the lower half of the spectrum?
Yeah. I'd say it's on the lower half.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm in agreement with both of y'all. I would even maybe go as far as to say this is my least favorite episode.
Okay.
I'm trying to think of another episode that I like less than this one. But it's not bad. Once again, it's Rick and Morty, and I consider Rick and Morty to be a pretty exceptional television.
My least favorite one is the one with the gooey Rick and Morty, you know.
Toxic Rick?
Yeah. Oh, I love that one.
I don't.
I guess the other one I don't like is the Season 3, Episode 10, the Rick Turian candidate with the...
Oh, that
with
one
the,
was great.
I just don't like the Rick versus the president. I feel like it was all Dan Harmon paranoid political humor.
We talked about it.
Yeah, we're talking about
really
this one
liked
here.
It a lot.
Yeah, I don't know. For me, this one, I actually probably like the Anatomy Park plotline better than the Christmas at the Smiths plotline. I didn't really find it very funny, and I thought that it actually wrapped up in a really kind of clumsy way, like the way that technology is all of a sudden becomes the savior again in this ironic way is just really, I just didn't really think it worked. And then like at the end, Summer says,
We didn't learn anything.
And that's true, but I don't know.
That's
kind of like apologizing to the audience, and I think that works sometimes, but... I don't know. Just because your characters don't learn anything and you admit that doesn't mean that we should get the same kind of satisfaction as if they do learn something, even if it's a cynical lesson, which I do believe that this was supposed to be. Like, they are supposed to learn something. They're supposed to learn cynically that, oh, human connection is not great for the holidays. We should just go back to our electronics because they're comforting, right?
I really like this plot line because last, I think, Squanch episode, we were talking about, like, Rick flaunting with authenticity and it going terribly wrong. And I feel like this episode, I didn't remember it, but is kind of like that, where you have Jerry's parents who are doing this like authentic, maybe wholesome thing, even though like it's a little weird. And, you know, Jerry hates it and Beth's okay with it. And authentically sort of trying to connect, you know, human to human. But that goes wrong, but only because Jerry's a dumbass. It's working for Beth and Summer and for everyone else. So I don't know, like, I wish they would maybe do a little bit more of this. Do I think it was the best execution? I don't know. I'm more okay with the fact that they didn't learn anything, because isn't that the whole point of the show?
Yes and no. We'll go into that in more detail, but let me first go into the recap. So it's Christmas at the Smith house, and Jerry is hell-bent on everyone being more present for this year's festivities, so he bans electronic devices, and his parents arrive with their unexpected guest, Jacob, a young man who his parents describe as a life partner. Meanwhile, Rick takes his homeless Santa friend Ruben into the garage for his yearly checkup. He shrinks Morty and sends him inside Ruben's body, which turns out is a biology-themed attraction called Anatomy Park. Inside, Morty meets Dr. Zenon Bloom, the mercenary Poncho, a dude named Roger, and the smoking hot Annie. Bloom reveals the park's main attraction isn't the anatomy-themed rides, but rather a zoo-like spectator experience of some of the world's deadliest diseases. Problem is, the diseases have escaped and are running amok. Back at Christmas dinner, Jerry's father reveals the nature of their relationship with Jacob. He's Jerry's mother's lover, and Jerry's dad loves watching them have sex while dressed like Superman, sometimes in a closet. A dangerous trip through the alveoli forest reveals that Ruben has tuberculosis, and he promptly dies. On the way to the digestive tract to escape, Dr. Bloom tells Morty to watch out because the park may have been sabotaged by one of the crew. Jerry finds himself being the only one not enjoying the, quote, more human Christmas. And when Summer's boyfriend shows up demanding to know why she hasn't texted him back, Jacob starts to heal the situation, telling Jerry he doesn't connect with his family enough. The theme park saboteur is revealed to be Poncho, who dies alongside Roger when they realize they can't escape through the colon. Morty gets some play from Annie after his stellar heroics, and Rick realizes the best way to save them is to send Ruben's body into space and inflate the whole body to the size of the country, thereby also making Morty back to regular size. Rick gets in a ship, picks up Annie and Morty, and escapes as Ruben explodes, covering the entire country in blood rain. The family panics when they see the blood, but the TV Jerry is watching saves the day when the newscaster nonchalantly says, "Everything is fine." Jerry distributes electronic devices and everyone relaxes. Rick bottles Annie to make another Anatomy Park, and when Rick and Morty rejoin the family, they're all glued to their electronics, and Rick ironically laments that this is an inhuman Christmas. End of episode. So the first thing I want to talk about is how the A and B plots connect. So maybe I'm stretching here, but it seems like in the A plot, the B plot rather, I don't even know which one you would call A and B, but Jerry is striving for a more human Christmas to be more connected with his fellow people. And similarly, the B plot has another significant focus on the human, where we see the inside of a human, a very intimate look at humanity's biology. But both of these in classic Rick and Morty fashion are subverted. So we have the authentic human connection ends up being disgusting, at least to Jerry, with Jacob and his Superman t-shirt wearing cuckolding father. And
played by Dana Carvey.
Was that Dana Carvey? Yeah. I wasn't sure. Who played Dr. Bloom then?
That was Oliver.
John Oliver.
Okay. And inside the human body is not only disease infested, but colonized by Rick as a ploy to make money, which didn't really make sense to me, but he did say that he was trying to make a buck doing it. So what do you guys think? Did that cross your mind the way that these two plots intersect? Did that do anything for you guys?
I was actually thinking about this in terms of STDs. this lifestyle by Jerry's parents, are they more prone to STDs? The same kind of STDs that are all over Rufus. Ruben, God damn it. I think that's a very far stretch.
I was wondering, I was like, so does that mean all of America just contracted hepatitis A through C?
Because
splattered.
If anyone's an epidemiologist, can you catch?
You know, that's not something that people point to when they're like, oh, this is evidence that maybe Rick had to switch dimensions again. But I think, you know, covering the whole country in diseased blood is, I think people need to revisit that one.
But also massive, like, bubonic plague that's now the size of, like, Morty pretty much.
That's right. That's not good.
Well, hopefully that all got blown up in the explosion, right?
Right.
Heat is sterilizing, but I don't know. You never know.
But no, to answer your question, Jared, that didn't really cross my mind until you just said it right now.
Right. I mean, I guess here's my problem. Let's go ahead and kind of go to my issue with the B plot, which is Jerry attempting to make Christmas more human and it ends up backfiring. So at the end, the whole way that this goes full circle is that the blood rain starts happening and everyone freaks out. And then they go into the den where Jerry's watching TV and the newscaster says that everything's okay. And, you know, there's this joke, which I think is a good joke, where Jerry says, oh, everything's fine. Don't worry about the blood rain because the TV says so. The TV says everything's okay, therefore everything's okay, which is a good classic paranoid Dan Harmon joke. But
it's a classic Jerry joke. Jerry would believe that the TV
everyone is believing it.
Right. But that's a very Jerry line. Like, the TV said it's okay, so it's okay.
And I guess, so all the humanity they're willing, all the connection, how Jacob rehabilitates Summer's relationship and how everyone's getting closer and are doing drum circles, all that is thrown out the window and they go back to just being solo, consuming stuff through their electronic media simply because they realize, like, oh man, we were really scared about the blood rain, but the television told us everything is okay. Therefore, electronics are relaxing. Therefore, we should all go to electronics.
Well, I don't know about that therefore in the middle, because I mean, when Jerry says the TV says it's okay, so it's okay. So I feel like he believes that. And mm-hmm. then he's like, you know what? These electronics really relax us, right? So I feel like for him, no one else wanted to give up their electronics at the beginning. So once they're getting it handed back to him, they're all just like, oh, cool, I got this back. Now I'm going to start fuck everything I just learned in the last hour. And just because it's a crutch, basically. I feel like Jerry's the only one.
Yeah, but why would they forget? Why would they say fuck everything I've learned in the last hour if we're meant to believe that it was a positive development?
Well, I think that's one of the reasons it's a bad episode. Well,
no, I agree, because I think that it would have been better, or this whole thing would have been more cynical in classic Rick and Morty style, if the kind of human connective element goes wrong, where, maybe Jacob takes it too far, and then maybe Summer realizes that her boyfriend's been cheating on her, or vice versa, and then the technology comes in and maybe just eases everybody's pain and makes them forget about whatever conflict they have. But instead, the blood rain just kind of comes in, and it just seems very half-assed in that we're usually the cynicism is one of the most well thought out points of a Rick and Morty episode, where we realize, oh, haha, the show is so clever because it's showing us why things that we usually take as sacred, like humanity or connection, are all bullshit. But I felt like this one was particularly lazily done.
Yes.
Yeah, because it's like blood rain and just this crisis of what's going on outside. And then like, oh, the electronics are easing our anxiety of what's going on outside. Therefore, fuck human connection. Let's just relax ourselves with electronics. That doesn't seem like a very strong statement to me.
To summarize, I think, your point a little bit, I think if Jerry's parents and Summer and Beth were sort of given, if they were given a meaningful choice to go back to the electronics based on everything going wrong with this sort of human connection, I think it would have been a lot stronger. Instead, the choice is based on that it's raining blood outside. But before that, we see Summer's making out with her boyfriend. Not really sure what Beth is doing, but Jerry's dad is in the closet watching his wife make out with Jacob. And everyone seems super happy. And it's sort of like, oh, why go back to the TV, except that this Deus Ex blood in the sky, even though it's not really Deus Ex, but you get what I'm saying. Like, for that,
right. And then that moment where I guess the body from the A plot, which is Ruben's body, or you know, that human element, that gross human element, enters the A plot, which is the human element of an old woman wanting to have sex with a young man and being more connected and stuff. I feel like they could have those human themes could have intersected a little bit better. Like, I don't know, if they saw the raining blood and then it was revealed
blood
that
orgy.
Jacob and grandma liked blood orgies or something. If there was some way that those things could collide,
you're right,
I think
it
would be a little bit
scene.
Better, yeah.
Do you think another part of it, though, is, or that we're supposed to take, is that just that how, they were so close to having this human Christmas, and then pretty much Rick fucked everything up because it all kind of indirectly came from Rick. So then Rick is the one that kind of caused them to go back to their electronics and not learn anything.
I think that's what they're trying to achieve. But I don't think it really works that well.
Right.
Because once again, the blood rain doesn't really fuck anything up that much. I mean, they get anxious for like a split second.
Well, it fucks up their human Christmas.
But if anything, you know, like the classic rom-com trope of being snowed in and stuff, you know, if anything, the blood rain is like, oh, we can't go outside, so we got to stay together and be more close together because we can't go outside, we can't go anywhere. I mean, it doesn't go in that direction, but it could have easily, is what I'm saying.
When Summer has that moment where she says, oh, we didn't learn anything, I definitely, like, all the kind of tension from the episode kind of just drains out, and you're just kind of like, okay,
right,
this is lame, kind of.
Right. I guess they learn that electronics are relaxing, but it's almost more of a admission of being a sloppy episode than it is actually them not learning anything. It's just that, like, we kind of learn something, and it's that we should have more faith in our electronics because they relax us from conflict or something like that.
Do you think that's what the episode's saying, is that we should have more faith in our electronics? I think it's just saying...
No, I mean, like, in a cynical way.
Yeah, it's more just saying, like, you really just like these things because they make you feel good.
Right, like, you can get away from any real problems. Like, the joke is that, yeah, there's fucking rain falling out of the sky. You should be concerned no matter what the TV tells you, even if it's just like, you know, everything's fine.
Yeah.
And, you know, electronics are there to numb you from that. And that's supposed to be cynical, but I just don't think it really builds off what was previously explored in the episode.
Yeah.
All right, so moving on. One thing I do admire about this episode is that one of the main tenets of Rick and Morty is a lot of allusions to sci-fi and in some cases other films. So there's three big allusions that I've pointed out here. But let's start with the one that I think is the least obvious. And I'm actually curious if, Ryan, if this crossed your mind. Do you see this episode, specifically the B plot with Jerry and his parents, as a variation on Guess Who's Coming to Dinner with Sidney Poitier?
Yeah, I can totally see that. It's like an inversion of it. Completely right. It's so, usually the grandparents are more conservative, but they're the ones into all this freaky shit.
Right.
And they're coming over. Yeah, I had not thought about that, but that's totally.
Can you give us a primer for those uninitiated?
In Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, it's the story of
Spencer Tracy, Katharine Hepburn, and Sidney Poitier, right?
Right. And so it's Katharine Hepburn is the daughter, and she's bringing her boyfriend, which is Sidney Poitier, which is a black actor, very famous black actor, bringing him, her boyfriend, to dinner to meet the parents. And the parents are the supposed liberals who believe in racial equality, yet when they're actually confronted with it, that their own daughter is getting engaged to a black man, they're a little bit iffy on it.
And, you know, this is in the 60s, right? Early 60s. So
right.
The climate was prime for this kind of movie.
Right. This, you know, is back, in the, controversial this is back film. In the Archie Bunker days.
This sounds like a bizarre version of Get Out.
You could definitely draw those comparisons for sure. And I guess that similarly, Jerry at the beginning is all about living a more authentic, connected experience without technology. But once he's actually confronted with that, with his parents and their love for the what I would consider perhaps the Sidney Poitier stand-in, he's grossed out. So
there's also the whole Superman element. I mean, it's not just that, like, that they're in a relationship together. They're
Of course.
All this weird shit.
Of course, right. The cuckolding like with the Superman
thing. The role-playing and stuff, yeah.
Right. Well, I guess what I'm just saying is that there's similarity in that, just as in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, the parents are supposedly into racial equality, when they're actually confronted with it, they're a little bit hesitant. And then similarly, Jerry's all about living a authentic, connected experience. But then when he's actually confronted with it, he's, you know, a little resistant.
Well, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And also his parents frame it all as a hyper connectivity of bodies. It's that he believes in connectivity, but he has to connect with his parents who want to connect their bodies to other people in lots of interesting and creative ways.
Yeah, his parents say that, you know, we realize that life is just a series of events and we should accumulate as much as possible. I found that to be very empowering.
Yeah, I love all the dialogue from parents. I'm like, yes. And this is kind of funny because of the Superman cape, but also I agree with you.
Yeah, we don't see much. We never have seen Jerry's parents again.
It makes me sad. I want to see more of this. I want to see more of Jerry's parents. I want to see more of Jacob.
I love see more, Dana Carvey. More,
yeah. And what's the boyfriend's name? Whatever happened to
Ethan, dude. Ethan, whoever does the voice acting for Ethan is a fucking rock star. That is a great part. He gets so much mileage out of just saying, like, you know, Summer, you stupid bitch. It's the way he inflects it. It's pretty amazing work.
I feel like in this episode in general, I feel like there are a lot of kind of uncharacteristic moments in this episode where, for example, like, they introduce elements that we never see in the rest of the show. So one, I mean, we do see Ethan one other time in the, like, whatever, the Clive Barker episode in season three. But why is it that Summer's always so concerned about her body and is always looking at the popular kids in school and always worried about being so popular?
She's
and
a high schooler.
Well, but also worrying about making her boobs bigger. But she has a boyfriend.
Well, for one, you got to remember that this is the third episode in the whole series, right? And we saw, didn't she have a boyfriend in the first episode that got broken from ice?
I don't think that was her boyfriend.
That was just a guy she was infatuated with.
Right.
But then I think part of the joke, if you're watching it, like in the third episode, all of a sudden she's had this boyfriend for a while. So you're supposed to kind of, that's supposed to be kind of a joke. You know what I mean? Like, you don't know how much time has passed since the second and third episode, basically. But anyway.
I was just going to say that I don't think, like, low self-esteem goes away once you're dating somebody.
That makes sense. So did you, all right, so I'll let that one pass. You guys are probably right. So, but other things, did you feel like Morty in this episode was uncharacteristically brave?
No. Yeah, but it's because he's trying to get laid.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I believe that, but man, he's eager to climb up the aiolis. He attacks and ultimately kills Poncho and comes up with ideas on the fly of how to kill Hepatitis B. Like, yeah, it's to get laid, but I feel like in the rest of the show, Morty is... Well, I think there's another element here, is that how many adventures do we see Morty on solo without Rick?
Oh, that's a good point.
Well, he is with Rick. I mean, Rick's in his headset.
Right, but usually we see Rick pushing Morty in a direction that he's very hesitant to go in. Mm-hmm. And now without Rick, Morty's like a badass in this whole episode.
I wish there would have been a little bit more pushback from Morty. You know, he would have been a little scared at the episode at the beginning. Cause, you know, two episodes ago, if you remember the first scene of the fucking thing, you know, he's getting drugged out of bed. And he's all scared. You know, he's like, I don't know, Rick.
Yeah.
And then here it's just like, all right, hey, I'm going to put you inside of this homeless dude. You know?
He's a little concerned at first, but then once he meets the rest of the team, he's like one of the driving forces towards survival, and he's the one taking all the action, which...
That's probably part of the joke, too, is just that there's all these badasses. It's like a commando team, you know?
I also think that's an element of writing in that if your two main characters are Rick and Morty, one of them has to be driving the plot forward. One of them has to be going head-to-head with conflict. Usually it's Rick, but if he's not there in the actual action... inside the body, then it kind of just has to be Morty.
Yeah, I think as a technical thing, you're probably right. But I think it's part of the joke that he wants to get laid. And because doesn't he kill the swole guy after he attacks, what's her name? Annie.
He's got a knife to Annie's throat. And yeah, that's what Morty ultimately like jumps on him. But even that is pretty ballsy. I mean, he's a huge, swole guy with a knife.
Dude, he's in love, man.
Yeah, he's in love.
I guess he's in love. Well, that's the other thing I was going to say.
It's like the mom lifting cars off her toddlers.
He gets legitimate play in this episode. Like, Annie makes out with him, tells him he can put his fingers wherever he wants. Usually, Morty's, like, perpetually sexually frustrated, except for the episode you said you don't like, the toxic episode. Yeah. But that's because it's part of the joke that he's all of a sudden super healthy. But I don't know. It's almost like... It's weird to me to see him succeed sexually.
I agree. This is an outlier episode for Morty, I think. But speaking of him getting action with Annie, you know what? So we're supposed to believe she's probably his age, right? 14?
It's never revealed exactly. He says that he's 14, but...
And not 12.
And not 12.
But the one really weird comment at the end of the episode when Rick just goes, she's got a puffy vagina. And yeah. I'm like, what the fuck? Like, so is she 14 and is Rick talking about her puffy vagina? And how does he know she has a puffy vagina? And
Well, that's another thing. Who even are these people? Like,
she works at the churro stand inside of the homeless person.
Right, but I know. But how did she get there? Is she like a regular person that Rick shrank and like made her an employee? Is she like some sort of bacteria?
She's not bacteria because she looks like a human. I think that all these people were like kind of like commando black ops people that Rick's, you know, finds, and they're contractors basically.
Okay.
they're human beings except
for Dr. Zenon Bloom, who is something.
Right. He's some sort of bacteria.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know what Dr. Bloom is, Alec?
Some kind of amoeba, bacteria. I don't know.
Well, and if we're supposed to take this to its logical conclusion, are the people that were supposed to come and patronize this anatomy park, were they supposed to be human beings that were shrunk, or were they supposed to be people like Dr. Bloom?
I was wondering the same thing. Like, and do these people have currency? Like, why is it that this is like some sort of a side hustle for Rick? Like, how is he going to be making money off of this? Yeah, yeah. That never really made sense to me either.
But yeah, back to the puffy vagina. What is y'all's interpretation? Why did he say that? And what does it mean?
I don't even know what a puffy vagina is.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, what? That's a whole other point, but it's kind of like... Why did Rick say it about Annie, the 14-year-old that works at the Truist stand and is parking maid?
We don't know she's 14, all right? You're going to get Dan Harmon in trouble.
I know. That's why I'm trying to prevent that. What are we, someone else interpret the joke for
me? I guess
me.
She's a solid 18.
Okay. And, making out with a 14-year-old that might 14, be a 12.
A 14-year-old that just saved her life, you know? I mean, hey.
I guess that makes it okay.
And I don't know. I don't know what a puffy vagina is either. Please tweet at us at Wisecrack. Explain what a puffy vagina is.
Please tell us what.
Email us at squanch@wisecrack.co. Please, if you've ever encountered a puffy vagina, please.
Female Wisecrack fans, what are puffy vaginas all about?
Yeah. And is that about, I mean, you know, most, I think puffy is overall a pretty positive adjective. Like, I like puffy things.
You like puffy Cheetos?
All right. Next point.
Next point.
Wait. I have a theory.
Oh, okay. Please.
It's not what it actually is, but I don't know if you've ever resorted or had this tactic done to you where people will make up something that's wrong with you and you're so self-conscious. You're like, oh my God. Like, you could say, oh, your lips are shaped weird. What does that even fucking mean? But if you're 12, you're totally be like, oh my God, my lips are ugly and disgusting.
So you think Rick is fucking with Morty?
Yeah, kind of. Like, I'm going to invent this fake measure of what an attractive vagina is.
It seemed like he was trying to give him advice.
He could have come up with something better than that.
Yeah. No, the whole point is it's something inane that doesn't make any sense.
Okay.
I think, yeah, all right. I think this is a classic, a gag is just a gag, but it's okay. So the other thing I wanted to bring up where there's two other big illusions that are much more obvious. So the other one is obviously Jurassic Park.
Mm-hmm. Disney World.
Well, yeah, with the Small World After All stuff.
And the Pirates of the Pancreas.
And
Pirates of
the Pancreas.
And the Haunted Mansion. Didn't they have like a haunted?
Yeah, that's his
Did
liver.
They?
That's his liver.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah, so with Jurassic Park, so instead of dinosaurs escaping and running amok, it's diseases that are meant to look like hulking prehistoric monstrosities. And then in Jurassic Park, it's the fat guy that sabotages the
Newman.
Park.
Newman, yeah.
Newman, exactly, because he's trying to escape with one of the embryos. And then in this one, it's Poncho who tries to escape with bubonic plague to sell to the highest bidder, which even that, like, seemed a little... I had to, like, watch that a couple times. Like, so wait, Poncho is trying to escape the body with bubonic plague so he can sell it to ISIS or Al-Qaeda or something
North
like
Koreans
that?
North Koreans or the Republicans.
Or Republicans, right. So that's good to know.
what are you saying though about it? Like, were you confused about it?
Well, yeah, because how does him escaping, how does that connect with him spreading tuberculosis to Reuben and killing him? Why can't he just escape with bubonic plague?
So he doesn't get caught, no evidence? I don't know.
Yeah. It seems like he's just drawing attention to himself if he kills their host.
I think he's just trying to burn it all to the ground so he has a monopoly on bubonic plague.
Other people can get bubonic plague.
Oh, can they? Okay.
All right. Well, we've hit another stopping point. I actually have not seen Jurassic Park in quite a while.
I have.
Are there other parallels that I'm not thinking of?
I mean, the whole thing is one big Jurassic Park parody.
And then Zenon Bloom looks like the Jurassic Park head honcho dude.
And they have the animatronic, like Reuben as an animatronic saying, hey, welcome to the park. And, you know, they have that whole thing with the mosquito, the animated mosquito intro, you know.
I haven't seen Jurassic Park since I was a little kid.
It's like the welcome to Jurassic Park, the welcome to Anatomy Park. They also had he said, oh, if we don't move, they can't see us.
The gonorrhea can't see us if we don't move.
The gonorrhea can't see us, yeah.
Oh. It was like, and it's wait, that's a T-Rex.
Yeah, exactly.
That makes sense.
Those are the main ones.
Isn't it like Dr. Zenon Bloom has a walking stick, or it's like a staff, and then on the top of it looks like the thing that the mosquitoes are trapped in?
Yeah, the amber. Yeah.
The amber.
Yeah. Except his staff is made out of what looks like a femur, or at least some kind of bones.
Mm.
I had a question. When hepatitis C kills hepatitis A, there's kind of a meta joke about, wait, why did that just help us? Does something like that happen in Jurassic Park where like a dinosaur kills another dinosaur? Tell me about it, Ryan.
I honestly can't. It might not have even been in the first Jurassic Park, but there's certainly a scene where you're about to get the people are about to get attacked by a big old dinosaur, and then all of a sudden a mother T-Rex comes and eats that thing, and they're like, "Wow, thank you," but wait, shouldn't we be scared of you too?
Right.
You know?
Yeah, you know, that final joke, or that joke didn't really work for me either. Like the whole thing with like, thanks, hepatitis C, and then hepatitis C gives him a thumbs up and then walks away. Right. I just felt like that wasn't dramatized very well. Like, you know, the whole like, thanks, blank, and then they, you know, give a thumbs up, smile, and then ride off into the sunset. I feel like it was just not, it just wasn't animated well, if it wasn't directed well. I just don't think that joke landed as well as it could have.
Yeah, the whole thing was just kind of full of, that was kind of funny.
Yeah.
I have a fun science fact.
Oh, let's hear it.
So the E. coli that kill Xenon Bloom as they're trying to escape in the bone train, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
So those aren't shaped like E. coli, which I kind of suspected, but actually are shaped like a virus that infects E. coli. It's called lambda phage. I think I'm pronouncing that wrong. But like
Did you just read that?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I was Googling around. But if you Google the image of it, like the structure where the little crystal thing is where the DNA of the virus is, and then like the body of it like transmits it into E. coli cells and infects it.
I'll go back and pause that.
What about bubonic plague? Does that look accurate?
I have no idea.
It's like a little black blob.
I mean, all bacteria, I think they just look like blobs.
I love the it's a small world and small intestine joke. And then they're like, and now we're going to go to the big one.
Yeah, that was funny.
So I wanted to ask you all a question about, like, Rick seems to, we have the authenticity in the B plot, but also Rick himself flirts with it in a way that he never has before with his love of Pirates of the Pancreas. And also when he comes out, just him being like, oh, this is the day of our Lord and Savior. Like, what are you guys doing?
That was another thing that I was going to say is kind of strangely uncharacteristic in this episode. Like, even though we're, of course, we all know that he's being sarcastic.
Yeah.
But not about Pirates of the Pancreas.
Not about Pirates of the Pancreas.
That's his passion project.
I wasn't really crazy about, you know what I actually thought? Well, we'll get back to this, but what I actually thought you were going to say, Alec, is that at the beginning it teases you to think that, oh, Rick is bringing in Ruben because he's an ex-veteran and, you know, he's giving him a checkup. And then it turns out he's just using his body for some money to create a theme park inside of it. So, like, you know, that's kind of, that human element is undercut. But the Pirates of the Pancreas thing, yeah, I don't know, that was just a gag that didn't really work for me that much.
Really? I like that part.
I especially
how they ended it, you know, I feel like this has happened before with Rick, like Rick gets really invested emotionally in something. And then the second that there's just kind of any like, buddy he has to collaborate with or anything, kind of like in the Devil Curse Be Gone shop, mm-hmm. It's just kind of, he's like, you know what? Fuck all this. Because there's that whole conference call at the end with him and all the people, managers
the
inside.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And they're like, you know, oh, we were thinking about Pirates of the Pancreas internally. And he's like, and then he hangs up on him. That was funny.
Yeah. One of the best things about Rick is that he hates bureaucracy and doesn't stand for any of it. And I think that's essential for any true rebel. But yeah, I mean, as far as the Christ thing, he says, did you know Christ was born today? You know, our Lord and Savior. What kind of human people are you? Like, I don't know. Like, even sarcasm saying that for Rick seems just odd to me.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
Why?
Because
he's making fun of it.
Is he? Is he making fun? He's making fun of them.
Right.
But I don't know.
He's saying, I thought you guys were
like,
all
it's weird for him to even sarcastically bring up religion without him undermining it. Because that's what he does the whole show. Religion is bullshit. Tradition is for idiots. Blah, blah, blah.
But he is doing that in a way. I thought your God was born on this day. Look at you all just not paying attention to your God, just sitting there on your phones. Fuck all y'all. You know, that's kind of what the tone I got.
Yeah, I mean,
it's not like he believes it.
I mean, I think that since we all know Rick, that's, and the sarcasm is pretty clear. And since we all know Rick, I do think you're probably right. And that's what we're supposed to take out of it. But it's just weird hearing Rick even sarcastically refer to Christ as a Lord and Savior.
Okay.
It would be one thing if they were worshiping or at church and Rick was like, oh yeah, Christ, your Lord and Savior. But it's another thing for them, like, you know, it's as if they weren't going to church and Rick said, hey, it's Sunday. Aren't you supposed to go worship your Lord and Savior? That's a little bit weird because then he's criticizing them for not being sanctimonious, whereas usually Rick criticizes people for being sanctimonious.
I see your point.
It's not a big deal. It's just something that I noticed. But anyway, on to the last illusion is Fantastic Voyage. So the movie made in, was it the 60s?
Or Inner Space.
Oh, I don't know that movie. What's that?
You know that Outer Space with Martin Short? They've shrunk, just a Joe Dante movie. They shrink him down. It's a comedy. It's really funny. I haven't seen that one. You got to see that one.
Right. So in terms of subverting, so in Fantastic Voyage, when people are shrunk and they go inside of someone's body, it's depicted as it's beautiful and it's wonderful and the incredible nature of the human body and all its nuanced complexities. Whereas in this episode, it's a disease-fueled nightmare. So a more classic Rick and Morty, not only alluding to something within the science fiction canon, but subverting it. So
did you notice the, I thought you would particularly appreciate the double reversal on the, when Bloom is getting eaten by the E. coli, but not really E. coli.
See, I didn't like that part.
Really? He says, yeah. He's like, it's only manual. So I guess I'll sacrifice myself. It's only fair. And he's like, oh wait, there is an autopilot. Wait. Oh, never mind. I want to sacrifice myself anyway. I thought I kind of liked it.
I like the fucking with the trope of people, you know, the heroic person who sacrifices themselves for the greater good. I mean, that was funny, but I kind of up to that point thought like they almost play that character Bloom up like he's kind of a nefarious guy that has something to hide, kind of, I thought. And I was like, are they going to reveal that he's kind of a bad guy at some point? And then, no, they just kind of like he is kind of an asshole because he says, hey, Morty, you should sacrifice yourself. And he's like, no, that's a dick move. I'll just do it. And, you know, which was funny as a throwaway line, but kind of for his character, I'm like, wait, what are we supposed to believe about this guy? And then he just dies. He just sacrifices himself and he doesn't really want to. The whole thing was kind of like, oh, that's kind of funny, but not hilarious.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Not a laugh out loud moment for me, but yeah, I mean, I appreciate it. I mean, I definitely got it. It definitely worked within the sci-fi, Jurassic Park, Fantastic Voyage kind of things that they're playing with. All right, let's move into the mailbag. I believe Alec, as always, has some questions picked out.
Woo. Yeah, and if anyone wants to send us a question, you can hit us up at squanch@wisecrack.co. squanch@wisecrack.co. Before we get into the mailbag, there was a little bit of Twitter fury there, though, Jared.
But, oh, shit.
But, oh, this is my fault?
Well, it's not real Twitter fury, but
everything's my fault.
it actually is. But so we asked people to send us Rick and Morty porn names. Nobody did, but lots of people were outraged about your comments about music theory being boring. And I don't know.
I saw some emails where people that were into music theories were like, oh, yeah, we agree with you, Jared. It is pretty boring.
I didn't see those, but
I mean, it's just not my area of expertise. If somebody wants to prove me wrong, please email us. We'd love to get into music. And if someone can make music theory fun and sexy, I would love to learn about it. So, yeah, that's definitely not, I guess, really. I mean, when I think of music theory, I think of literally like, you know, the mathematics behind it and tone and rhythm and meter and stuff like that. And I don't know. Maybe that is interesting to some people. I'm not much of a math person, but, you know, I like to learn about pretty much everything. And I think that really my frustration or my challenge with creating music content is it's just very hard to interpret popular music without it being just pure conjecture. We've experimented with it in the past and we've kind of worked with some people that, you know, it's like right now we largely derive meaning from narrative. And without the narrative, it's very hard to, you know, really prove your point without it seeming just like pure nonsense. And the other thing is that, you know, our primary platform is YouTube, and even here on podcasting, it's the same thing in which you can't play the music that you're analyzing. I think that's probably less of a problem. And the more and more I talk to people, I think that perhaps podcasting is the way that we start talking about music. Because another thing is that YouTube is very visual. So, you know, how do we crack the code on making a visual element for music? But I mean, we're gonna get it, guys. Wisecrack is we're expanding to new frontiers, and we're gonna figure music out. We're gonna figure it out, guys. I did not mean to say that that analyzing or studying music is in any way shitty or boring. It's probably awesome, but it's just not something that's in my DNA right now. So, but I'd love to collaborate with somebody to crack the code.
So we got a specific tweet with a specific recommendation that I haven't had a chance to check out, so I hope it's good. But Megan Naxer was sad to hear that we weren't fans of music theory, well, specifically Jared, but want to recommend at FMLEHMAN and at Jim Bueller on The Last Jedi and Star Wars. Apparently there's a good video on Star Wars and music. I know John Williams is a very good composer, was inspired by a lot of like cool classical music. I don't know. I'd check it out.
I also, just looking at our email, and this guy named Robert said, "Good morning, team. I agree that a straight-up music theory podcast would be so incredibly boring, you would likely have fewer than zero listeners. However, there is a way to tackle this. I am classically trained and have many hours, weeks, years of theory training. You could pick something out of Bon Jovi's song and hear Mozart. You can hear Schumann and Nirvana, Coltrane and Kendrick. You can follow a single leitmotif through Trent Reznor's entire career. It's really fucking cool." So I think
that's a really good idea. Podcast. I would love to listen to hear Schumann and Kendrick Lamar.
Schumann and Nirvana, Coltrane and Kendrick.
I can't speak to those examples, but my music theory class in high school, shout out to Dr. Ford if you're even still alive, we would take like a very old song, usually starting like in Gregorian chant, like, you know, Middle Ages or if not before then, and see it traced through history. So like you can draw a line from like Gregorian chant church music to Black Sabbath, and it's fucking awesome.
Sweet.
Yeah. Well, yeah, hit up Dr. Ford.
If he's still alive.
If he's still alive.
He was very old, but I love the man.
Next email, Alec.
All right.
What you got for us?
Into the actual emails. So our first email comes from Chente. Hope I'm pronouncing that right. I was curious what your thoughts on were all the ice cream references that are used throughout all of season 3. By their estimate, at least 10 episodes have one ice cream reference. They even have that ice cream drive-through scene that was released after season 3 that's full of little details you guys could dissect. I'm going to be honest, I think I missed all of it except, and this isn't even season 3, that spider episode. Wait, didn't we just watch this?
Yeah, that was the Ricks Must Be Crazy.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, they're out to get ice cream, but when I rewatch season 3, I'll have to look out for the ice cream references, I guess.
God, now I'm racking my brain trying to think of just one ice cream reference.
Ryan, do you remember any?
No.
All right, well.
Well, shit. We'll have to do our homework and look at take some deep dives. I'm sad that I can't even think of one.
All right, so the next email comes from David. It's about our debate about the ethics of endowing a dog with sentience. David says, "I was fascinated by your recent discussion about ethics of endowing dogs with sentience because as an aspiring AI researcher, this is something I've thought a lot about. My question is, for those of you who think it is ethical to endow Snowball with sentience, do you extrapolate that to humans? In other words, do you think there's a moral imperative to have as many babies as possible? If not, what's the relevant difference between a potentially sentient proto-human and potentially sentient dog that hasn't gotten a genius helmet yet?"
This was a good email. We actually got a fair amount of emails about our sentience conversation. I'll read one here in a second. But my answer to that personally is just practicality. You know, like obviously, yeah, you could have as many babies as you could, but it's like, you know, at some point you're going to have diminishing returns because you're not going to be able to feed all of them, you know. So sentience is a good thing, but you don't have to like go crazy with it.
Is it a matter of potential? Like, so if we have whatever semen and eggs, they have potential to be sentient, therefore we should fulfill that potential, similar to if we have the technology to make a dog sentient, we ought to fulfill that potential. I don't know if I necessarily believe that.
I don't. Yeah, you get into a whole
do you guys know what
you open up a different
is?
Can of worms. What?
Quiverful. It's like a Christian movement.
No, what is that?
As far as I understand, they are a Christian group that essentially believes it's their duty on earth as God's followers to have as many babies as possible. Like Quiverful is a reference to a biblical passage that, you know, a good Christian is kind of like an arrow in the quiver of God in the fight against evil or something like that.
Okay.
I think that's where you like end up with people like the Duggars. But anyway, I don't necessarily buy that argument. I don't, you know, I'm more inclined to believe I'm more inclined to at least entertain the idea that it's immoral to create life than it is that we need to create as many babies as possible. And again, I don't fully believe that argument. I shouldn't even say I believe that argument on any scale, but like, it's an interesting thought experiment. Like, oh, is it even ethical for me to bring a child into the world? I'll think about it. But it's like, oh, should I be having 100 babies or as many babies as possible? Hell no.
Somebody else, I remember there was an email that said that their stomach turned.
Oh, yeah,
when
we can get to
we
that.
Were,
yeah, I have that.
Yeah, can we read that one?
All right, so this is from Sean. "The whole discussion of whether or not dogs like Snowball should be, quote, protected, end quote, from the, quote, burdens of knowledge, end quote, turned my stomach a little because it's extremely reminiscent of how some proponents of slavery justified it. That is the duty of an enlightened Western mind to protect savages from the burden of enlightenment. In order for this argument to be made, there needs to be an underlying assumption that the other, in this case dogs, but oftentimes in history simply other humans, are inherently inferior. I'd like to point out that even though Rick is the one who puts Snowball in a position to choose whether to become an intellectual equal to humans, it is Snowball who chooses to add the batteries to the device. If it's truly bliss to be ignorant, why doesn't he stop? At the end of the day, happiness is worth nothing compared to knowledge to be gained about ourselves and about the universe.
So Sean's on my side, right? And you guys are the slave owners, right? No.
First of all, I never said that I agree with that. I definitely was very careful with my words, and I said that I see the appeal of that.
I agree with Sean in that, you know, we're having a live discussion. We might maybe accidentally use sentience in the wrong way and stuff like that. But I do think, first of all, that Sean is right to point out that Snowball is given the choice. And I think the big distinction between, you know, slavery, for instance, is that, like, you have, like, people who are enslaved who have agency, who can make that choice. And if given that choice to learn or to read, or even at the most basic to escape, which they often try to do, would choose not to do it. In contrast, like, you know, a dog, for instance, there's not really a way, except in this fictional example, to sort of give them a choice. But you could say, you know, dogs are sometimes given the choice to escape and they do that. So, you know,
you're telling me you look at your dog just sitting there in bondage, not knowing what how much of a slave he is, and if you had the knowledge to give him his condition, you wouldn't give it to him. You brutal monster.
No, I'm not saying
First of
that.
All, I think my dog enslaves me, and I think he's perfectly happy. No, I mean I also, first of all, this doesn't make sense to me. How can a non-sapient, now that we know the appropriate word, how can a non-sapient be choose to have sapience when they can't even understand what sapience is? They can't even...
Well, right, but you're the third party that can make the choice for them, you know?
Right, but we're saying that Snuffles makes the choice.
I mean, I think this gets to Sean's point, which is that, like, you know, people who are enslaved have sapience, obviously. They have agency. They can choose those things. But a dog that is not sapient doesn't necessarily have that choice. However, what Rick does is he gives them a baseline knowledge, not necessarily sapience because, you know, he's just a little bit smarter, but enough knowledge to sort of get on the knowledge train,
put more
batteries in his helmet and become smarter, at which point the increase...
He's willing to take a leap of faith into the abyss, but he doesn't know what he's getting himself into.
Does anyone know what they're getting into? I mean, I certainly don't.
I mean, none of us have been put into a situation where we're making a choice of to, like... I don't think it's possible for someone to say, oh, I'm going to educate myself to a point to where I will suffer greater...
Oh, no, like, that happens all the happens. Time. That, I mean, the more I learn
but not
about... No, all the time.
No, I know. At a certain point, you reach, I guess, not literally sapient, because we're all inherently sapient, but I don't think... It just doesn't make sense if we have a non-sapient being. How could they even grasp sapience in terms of, like, making an educated choice of what they're getting themselves into?
I think there's a part of your argument I really disagree with in that, like, even us at... as sapient, as we learn more, like, there's tons of times I open up a history book and I just hate everything. But, you know, did I know that before I was opening it? Sometimes not. And
I agree. but now we're talking about the line between non-sapient and sapient. But yeah, I mean, I know.
But it's the same question. Like, as someone who likes to acquire knowledge for the sake of knowledge by reading books and doing God knows what, you know, do I actually know what I'm getting into before the fact? No. Do I sometimes regret it? Like, no, probably not, because I like that journey. But I think if you're saying the question is, do they know what they're getting into? I would say we don't even really know what we're getting into half the time.
Right. I guess the point I would argue is that even if you are educating yourself to a matter to that extent, you're never going to achieve a heightened level of consciousness as extreme as Snuffles before the batteries are inserted and Snuffles after the batteries are inserted.
Sure, but I think it's the same question of...
similar question.
Yeah, do you want the curse of knowledge? And you got to take that leap of faith, man.
You're saying, do you want the curse of knowledge? But the Snowball thing is, do you want the curse of sapience, which is
the curse of knowledge.
They definitely go hand in hand. But I think that, once again, like, if we have a certain level of knowledge and, like, let's say, oh, I saw The Matrix and it really depressed me, and now I'm going to go read, you know, Baudrillard, and it might depress me even more, then I know what I'm getting myself into, and that, you know, knowledge and increased education might make me a more aware and therefore a depressed person. But that's not the same as saying, like I'm going to jump into this heightened level of conscious that I can't even that I can't even conceive, you know, because then I don't know what I'm getting myself into at all.
Okay, how about this? Small kids, can we make the choice to educate them? Because do they know what they're getting into? They could stay dumb for the rest of their lives and maybe be happier than we are right now.
Right, but the reason we educate kids is because they have to serve a utility in our society or else, you know, they're going to burden the economy and everything's going to be fucked. But
that's why we educate kids?
Yes. But that's, you know, the same isn't the case for dogs. I mean, we don't need dogs to serve a utility in society other than being fun antidepressants for humans.
I mean, if you bracket out the labor pool thing, I would say that it gets tricky, and I'm still on the side of it's possibly unethical to grant anything sapience or even life, but I don't know. I'll entertain.
I'm on the side of life's cool, man.
But is life cool even if you're smart or not smart? Is life just as cool for a really smart, conscious person as it is for someone who's lower on that scale?
Yeah, I mean,
so it doesn't matter.
We've been saying ignorance is bliss, you know.
But like, but you're not saying that, I thought.
I'm saying that you can transcend your smartness and suffering.
So you're saying it just doesn't matter. Whether you're ignorant or not, you can choose to be happy.
Yes, I am saying that.
I have a tangible question/example. So every New Year's Eve, people line up for like 12 to 16 hours, sometimes in the freezing cold, to see the ball drop in Times Square. In my opinion, these people are idiots who literally piss in Gatorade bottles to be crammed in like cattle to see a ball drop. Meanwhile, I go bed at 10 o'clock. But
which
I can,
you can see on TV.
Yes. But my question is, as dumb as I think that is, those people, it's like the happiest moment of their life. They are so fucking happy. Am I really better off than them?
Because it's the most famous ball dropping in the world
at
that moment.
Exactly. Like I may like sneer at that, but I also have the self-awareness to be like, but really, who am I? And I think it's the same question.
But but are you equating your intelligence with your inability to enjoy that? Because I would probably assume that there are probably very intelligent people that are lining up for 15 hours and it makes them happy despite their intelligence level. I'm just assuming that. You know, just because people are intelligent doesn't mean that they're shut-ins like we are.
Yeah, you could say I'm not saying the people who go there are not intelligent, but the asshole part of my brain assumes that they must not be. And for anyone who's actually done it, I'm so sorry. But again, like the people who just sort of shut off that part of their brain and just like enjoy things, I'm a little jealous.
Oh yeah, me too, for sure. All right, I think we have time for one more question since we spent a lot of time on that one.
Our next one's an email from Jose about one of the parts of Lawnmower Dog that we didn't really get into. He says, way back in 2012, Justin pitched a show to Cartoon Network called Dog World, co-written by Ryan Ridley, about three kids who get sucked through a portal to a dimension where dogs are the dominant species and humans are their pets. There's a ton of references to this, he points out. So Rick's line about it being developed into a very satisfying project is clearly Roland joking about the show and the possibility of it getting developed. Rick accidentally calls Snuffles Ruffles, which is the name of the Doggerson family pet. The Doggersons are the same breed as Snuffles. And in Dog World, there is a Maury-based TV show where a dog keeps saying, you don't know me, over and over, as well as an ad for Bobbish that appears in Interdimensional Cable 2.
Mm. Yeah, we mentioned this a little bit in our first Rick and Morty references video that's on our YouTube channel. But we did not talk about that, and that's a cool piece of trivia.
Definitely. And for anyone who hasn't seen it, there's an animatic you can find online. If you just search for Dog World animatic, I think on YouTube, it's pretty good. I would watch it. I'd like to see it get developed for.
Do you like Dog World more or House of Cosby's?
I don't know if I've seen House of Cosby's in its entirety, so I can't say with certainty. I like the premise of House of Cosby's better.
All right, well, that just about does it for today. I want to thank my co-host Ryan and Alec for joining me.
Woo!
Before we go, where can everyone find you guys on the interwebs?
Well, I got a website, ryanhaley.com.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at Ryan's Game Show. Also, if you go to the Wisecrack Facebook page, there's this video called The Ethics of Eating Tide Pods that I highly recommend, and I'm the middle guy in the video.
Starring Ryan.
Starring and directed by Ryan.
It's the best thing on the internet that I've seen recently, and I don't say that lightly.
Thank you, Alec. What about you, Alec?
You can find me on Twitter at Alec_Opperman. That's OPPERMAN.
And Jared, what about you? Where can we find you on the internet?
You can either friend me on Facebook or just, you know, follow at Wisecrack on Twitter.
You're really going to open up the face space?
I've had people friend me on Facebook. I'm cool with that. You know, I'm all about the
Gotta get up to that 5,000 max friends, dog.
Oh, dude, I'm not even close. If you friend me on Facebook or anything on Instagram, you're just going to see a lot of pictures of my dog.
And the dog is awesome.
Oh, thank you. He actually kind of looks like Snuffles.
Yeah.
He looks so 100%. Shit ton like Snuffles, like almost exactly.
All right, just want to remind you guys that we are continuing our movie podcast, Show Me the Meaning. There is a link in the description of this podcast, so be sure to check that out. Make sure to leave a review for us. We've done movies such as Mean Girls, Old Boy, Videodrome. This week, we're doing the Oscar-nominated film Get Out. We're really excited about that one. It's one of my favorite movies of the year.
The Sunken Place.
Exactly. So we're going to be doing that. So be sure to check that out. Subscribe. Leave us a review, please. If we've ever given you just the slightest bit of joy in your life or even distracted you from an issue that you may have or, you know, kind of nullified some conflict in your life, just do us a solid and leave us a review. It means the world to us, especially on Show Me the Meaning and this podcast as well. But that just about does it for today. So thank you, Ryan. Thank you, Alec. And as always, thanks for listening, guys. Peace.
Wubba lubba dub dub. Outie.
Squanch you later.